This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett. Read for you by Shayna Small. Part 1. The Lost Twins, 1968. Chapter 1. The morning one of the lost twins returned to Mallard, Lou LeBon ran to the diner to break the news, and even now, many years later, everyone remembers the shock of sweaty Lou pushing through the glass doors, chest heaving, neckline darkened with his own effort. The barely awake customers clamored around him, 10 or so, although more would lie and say that they'd been there too, if only to pretend that this once they'd witnessed something truly exciting. In that little farm town, nothing surprising ever happened. Not since the Veens twins had disappeared. But that morning in April 1968, on his way to work, Lou spotted Desiree Veens walking along Partridge Road, carrying a small leather suitcase. She looked exactly the same as when she'd left, at 16, still light, her skin the color of sand, barely wet. Her hipless body reminding him of a branch caught in a strong breeze. She was hurrying, her head bent, and, Lou paused here, a bit of a showman. She was holding the hand of a girl, 7 or 8, and black as tar.
"Blue back," he said, "like she flown direct from Africa."
Lou's egg house splintered into a dozen different conversations. The line cook wondered if it had been Desiree after all, since Lou was turning 60 in May and still too vain to wear his eyeglasses. The waitress said that it had to be. Even a blind man could spot a Veens girl, and it certainly couldn't have been that other one. The diners, abandoning grits and eggs on the counter, didn't care about that Veens foolishness. Who on earth was the dark child? Could she possibly be Desiree's?
"Well, who else could it be?" Lou said.
He grabbed a handful of napkins from the dispenser, dabbing his damp forehead.
"Maybe it's an orphan that got took in. I just don't see how nothing that black could have come out of Desiree." "Desiree seemed like the type to take in no orphan, do you?"
"Of course she didn't. She was a selfish girl. If they remembered anything about Desiree, it was that, and most didn't recall much more. The twins had been gone 14 years, nearly as long as anyone had ever known them. Vanished from bed after the Founders' Day dance, while their mother slept right down the hall. One morning, the twins crowded in front of their bathroom mirror, 4 identical girls fussing with their hair. The next, the bed was empty, the covers pulled back like any other day, taut when Stella made it, crumpled when Desiree did. The town spent all morning searching for them, calling their names through the woods, wondering stupidly if they had been taken. Their disappearance seemed as sudden as the rapture, all of Mallard the sinners left behind. Naturally, the truth was neither sinister nor mystical. The twins soon surfaced in New Orleans, selfish girls running from responsibility. They wouldn't stay away long. City living would tire them out. They'd run out of money and gall and come sniffling back to their mother's porch. But they never returned again. Instead, after a year, the twins scattered, their lives splitting as evenly as their shared egg. Stella became white, and Desiree married the darkest man she could find. Now she was back, Lord knows why. Homesick, maybe. Missing her mother after all those years, or wanting to flaunt that dark daughter of hers. In Mallard, nobody married dark. Nobody left either. But Desiree had already done that. Marrying a dark man and dragging his blue-black child all over town was one step too far. In Lou's egg house, the crowd dissolved. The line cook snapping on his hairnet, the waitress counting nickels on the table, men in coveralls gulping coffee before heading out to the refinery. Lou leaned against the smudged window, staring out at the road. He ought to call Adele Veens. Didn't seem right for her to be ambushed by her own daughter, not after everything she'd already been through. Now Desiree and that dark child, Lord. He reached for the phone. You think they're fixing to stay? The line cook asked.
Who knows? She sure seemed in a hurry, though,
Lou said.
Wonder was she hurrying to? Look right past me, didn't wave or nothing.
Uppity. And what reason she got to be uppity?
Lord, Lou said, I never seen a child that black before.
It was a strange town. Mallard, named after the ring-necked ducks living in the rice fields and marshes. A town that, like any other, was more idea than place. The idea arrived to Alphonse Decure in 1848. As he stood in the sugarcane fields, he'd inherited from the father who'd once owned him. The father now dead, the now freed son wished to build something on those acres of land that would last for centuries to come. A town for men like him, who would never be accepted as white, but refused to be treated like Negroes. A third place. His mother, rest her soul, had hated his lightness. When he was a boy, she'd shoved him under the sun, begging him to darken. Maybe that's what made him first dream of the town. Lightness, like anything inherited at great cost, was a lonely gift. He'd married a mulatto even lighter than himself. She was pregnant then with their first child, and he imagined his children's children's children, lighter still, like a cup of coffee steadily diluted with cream, a more perfect Negro, each generation lighter than the one before. Soon others came. Soon idea and place became inseparable, and Mallard carried throughout the rest of St. Landry Parish. Colored people whispered about it, wondered about it. White people couldn't believe it even existed. When St. Catherine's was built in 1938, the diocese sent over a young priest from Dublin who arrived certain that he was lost. Didn't the bishop tell him that Mallard was a colored town? Well, who were these people walking about? Fair and blonde and redheaded, the darkest ones no swarthier than a Greek. Was this who counted for colored in America, who whites wanted to keep separate? Well, how could they ever tell the difference? By the time the Veens twins were born, Alphonse Decure was dead, long gone. But his great-great-great-granddaughters inherited his legacy, whether they wanted to or not. Even Desiree, who complained before every Founders Day picnic, who rolled her eyes when the founder was mentioned in school, as if none of that business had anything to do with her. This would stick after the twins disappeared. How Desiree never wanted to be a part of the town that was her birthright. How she felt that you could flick away history, like shrugging a hand off your shoulder. You can escape a town, but you cannot escape blood. Somehow, the Veens twins believed themselves capable of both. And yet, if Alphonse Decure could have strolled through the town he'd once imagined, he would have been thrilled by the sight of his great-great-great-granddaughters. Twin girls, creamy skin, hazel eyes, wavy hair. He would have marveled at them. For the child to be a little more perfect than the parents, what could be more wonderful than that? The Veens twins vanished on August 14th, 1954, right after the Founders Day dance, which everyone realized later had been their plan all along. Stella, the clever one, would have predicted that the town would be distracted. Sun drunk from the long barbecue in the town square. where Willie Lee, the butcher, smoked racks of ribs and brisket and hot links, then the speech by Mayor Fontenot, Father Cavanaugh blessing the food, the children already fidgety, picking flecks of crispy chicken skin from plates held by praying parents. A long afternoon of celebration while the band played, the night ending in a dance in the school gymnasium, where the grown folks stumbled home after too many cups of Trinity Thierry's rum punch, the few hours back in that gym pulling them tenderly toward their younger selves. On any other night, Sal De La Fosse might have peeked out his window to see two girls walking under moonlight. Adele Veens would have heard the floorboards creak. Even Lou LeBon, closing down the diner, might have seen the twins through the foggy glass panes. But on Founder's Day, Lou's egg house closed early. Sal, feeling suddenly spry, rocked to sleep with his wife. Adele snored through her cups of rum punch, dreaming of dancing with her husband at homecoming. No one saw the twins sneak out, exactly how they'd intended. The idea hadn't been Stella's at all. During that final summer, it was Desiree who'd decided to run away after the picnic. Which should not have been surprising, perhaps. Hadn't she, for years, told anyone who would listen that she couldn't wait to leave Mallard? Mostly she told Stella, who indulged her with the patience of a girl long used to hearing delusions. To Stella, leaving Mallard seemed as fantastical as flying to China. Technically possible, but that didn't mean that she could ever imagine herself doing it. But Desiree had always fantasized about life outside of this little farm town. When the twins saw Roman Holiday at the Nickel Theater in Opelousas, she'd barely been able to hear the dialogue over the other colored kids in the balcony, rowdy and bored, tossing popcorn at the white people sitting below. But she'd pressed against the railing, transfixed, imagining herself gliding above the clouds to some far-off place like Paris or Rome. She'd never even been to New Orleans, only 2 hours away. "Only thing waiting for you out there is wildness," her mother always said, which of course made Desiree want to go even more. The twins knew a girl named Farrah Thibodeau, who a year ago had fled to the city, and it sounded so simple. How hard could leaving be if Farrah, 1 year older than they, had done it? Desiree imagined herself escaping into the city and becoming an actress. She'd only starred in one play in her life, Romeo and Juliet in ninth grade. But when she'd taken center stage, she'd felt, for a second, that maybe Mallard wasn't the dullest town in America. Her classmates cheering for her, Stella receding into the darkness of the gym, Desiree feeling like only herself for once, not a twin, not one half of an incomplete pair. But the next year, she'd lost the role of Viola in Twelfth Night to the mayor's daughter, after her father had made a last-second donation to the school, and after an evening sulking in the stage wing as Mary Lou Fontenot beamed and waved to the crowd, she told her sister that she could not wait to leave Mallard. "You always say that," Stella said, "because it's always true." But it wasn't, not really. She didn't hate Mallard as much as she felt trapped by its smallness. She'd trampled the same dirt roads her entire life. She'd carved her initials on the bottom of school desks that her mother had once used, and that her children would someday, feeling her jacket scratching with their fingers. And the school was in the same building it had always been, all the grades together, so that even moving up to Mallard High hadn't felt like a progression at all, just a step across the hallway. Maybe she would have been able to endure all this if it weren't for everyone's obsession with lightness. Syl Guillory and Jack Richard arguing in the barbershop about whose wife was fairer, or her mother yelling after her to always wear a hat, or people believing ridiculous things, like drinking coffee or eating chocolate while pregnant might turn a baby dark. Her father had been so light that on a cold morning, she could turn his arm over to see the blue of his veins. But none of that mattered when the white men came for him. So how could she care about lightness after that? She barely remembered him now. It scared her a little. Life before he died seemed like only a story she'd been told. A time when her mother hadn't risen at dawn to clean white people's houses or taken in extra washing on the weekends, clotheslines zigzagging across their living room. The twins used to love hiding behind the quilts and sheets before Desiree realized how humiliating it was, your home always filled with strangers' dirty things.
"If it was true, then you'd do something about it," Stella said. She was always so practical.
On Sunday nights, Stella ironed her clothes for the entire week, unlike Desiree, who rushed around each morning to find a clean dress and finish the homework crushed in the bottom of her book bag. Stella liked school. She'd earned top marks in arithmetic since kindergarten, and during her sophomore year, Mrs. Belton even allowed her to teach a few classes to the younger grades. She'd given Stella a worn calculus textbook from her own Spelman days. And for weeks, Stella lay in bed, trying to decipher the odd shapes and long strings of numbers nestled in parentheses. Once, Desiree flipped through the book, but the equations spanned like an ancient language, and Stella snatched the book back, as if by looking at it, Desiree had sullied it somehow. Stella wanted to become a school teacher at Mallard High someday. But every time Desiree imagined her own future in Mallard, life carrying on forever as it always had, she felt something clawing at her throat. When she mentioned leaving, Stella never wanted to talk about it.
"We can't leave, Mama,"
she always said, and chastened, Desiree fell silent. "She's already lost so much," was the part that never needed to be said. On the last day of 10th grade, their mother came home from work and announced that the twins would not be returning to school in the fall. They'd had enough schooling, she said, easing gingerly onto the couch to rest her feet, and she needed them to work. The twins were 16 then, and stunned, although maybe Stella should have noticed the bills that arrived more frequently, or Desiree should have wondered why, in the past month alone, their mother had sent her to Fontenot's twice to ask for more credit. Still, the girls stared at each other in silence as their mother unlaced her shoes. Stella looked like she'd been socked in the gut.
"But I can work and go to school, too," she said. "I'll find a way."
"You can't, honey," her mother said. "You gotta be there during the day. You know I wouldn't do this if I didn't need to."
"I know, but..."
"And Nancy Belton got you teaching the class. What more do you need to learn?" She had already found them a job cleaning a house in Opelousas, and they would start in the morning. Desiree hated helping her mother clean, plunging her hands into dirty dishwater, stooping over mops, knowing that someday her fingers would also grow fat and gnarled from scrubbing white folks' clothes. But at least there would be no more tests or studying or memorizing, no more listening to lectures bored to tears. She was an adult now. Finally, life would really begin. But as the twins started dinner, Stella remained silent and glum, rinsing carrots under the sink.
"I thought," she said. "I guess I just thought..."
She wanted to go to college someday. And of course, she'd get into Spelman or Howard, or wherever else she wanted to go. The thought had always terrified Desiree. Stella moving to Atlanta or D.C. without her. A small part of her felt relieved. Now Stella couldn't possibly leave her behind. Still, she hated to see her sister sad.
"You could still go," Desiree said. "Later, I mean." "How? You have to finish high school first."
"Well, you can do that then. Night classes or something. You'll finish it in no time. You know you will."
Stella grew quiet again, chopping carrots for the stew. She knew how desperate their mother was and would never fight her on her decision. But she was so rattled that her knife slipped and she cut her finger instead.
"Damn it!"
she whispered loudly, startling Desiree beside her. Stella hardly ever swore, especially not where their mother might overhear. She dropped the knife, a thin red line of blood seeping out her index finger, and without thinking, Desiree stuck Stella's bleeding finger in her own mouth, like she'd done when they were little and Stella wouldn't stop crying. She knew they were far too old for this now, but she still kept Stella's finger in her mouth, tasting her metallic blood. Stella watched her silently. Her eyes looked wet, but she wasn't crying.
"That's nasty," Stella said, but she didn't pull away.
All summer, the twins rode the morning bus into Opelousas, where they reported to a giant white house hidden behind iron gates topped with white marble lions. The display seemed so theatrically absurd that Desiree laughed when she first saw them, but Stella only stared warily, as if those lions might spring to life at any moment and maul her. When their mother found them the job, Desiree knew the family would be rich and white. But she'd never expected a house like this. A diamond chandelier dripping from a ceiling so high, she had to climb to the top of the ladder to dust it. A long, spiraling staircase that made her dizzy as she traced a rag along the banister. A large kitchen she mopped, passing appliances that looked so futuristic and new, she could not even tell how to use them. Sometimes she lost Stella and had to search for her, wanting to call her name but afraid to send her voice echoing off the ceilings. Once she'd found her polishing the bedroom dresser, staring off into the vanity mirror adorned by tiny bottles of lotions, wistfully, as if she wanted to sit on that plush bench and rub scented cream onto her hands like Audrey Hepburn might. Admire herself for the sake of it, as if she lived in a world where women did such a thing. But then Desiree's reflection appeared behind her, and Stella looked away, ashamed, almost, to be seen wanting anything at all. The family was called the DuPonts, a wife with feathery blonde hair who sat around all afternoon, heavy-lidded and bored, a husband who worked at St. Landry Bank and Trust, two boys shoving each other in front of the color television set, she'd never seen one before, and a colicky, bald baby. On their first day, Mrs. DuPont studied the twins a minute, then said absently to her husband, "What pretty girls. So light, aren't they?" Mr. DuPont just nodded. He was an awkward, fumbling man who wore Coke bottle glasses with lenses so thick his eyes turned into beads. Whenever he passed Desiree, he tilted his head as if he were quizzing himself.
"Which one are you again?"
he'd ask.
"Stella,"
she sometimes told him, just for fun. She'd always been a great liar. The only difference between lying and acting was whether your audience was in on it. But it was all a performance just the same. Stella never wanted to switch places. She was always certain that they would get caught. But lying or acting was only possible if you committed fully. Desiree had spent years studying Stella, the way she played with her hem, how she tucked her hair behind her ear, or gazed up hesitantly before saying hello. She could mirror her sister, mimic her voice, inhabit her body in her own. She felt special, knowing that she could pretend to be Stella, but Stella could never be her. All summer, the twins were out of sight. No girls walking along Partridge Road, or sliding into a back booth at Lou's, or heading to the football field to watch the boys practice. Each morning, the twins disappeared inside the DuPont's house, and in the evening, they emerged exhausted, feet swollen, Desiree slumping against the bus window during the ride home. Summer was nearly over, and she couldn't bring herself to imagine autumn, scrubbing bathroom floors while her friends gossiped in the lunchroom and planned homecoming dances. Would this be the rest of her life? Constricted to a house that swallowed her as soon as she stepped inside. There was one way out. She knew it. She'd always known it. But by August, she was thinking about New Orleans relentlessly. The morning of Founders Day, already dreading returning to the DuPonts, she nudged Stella across the bed and said, "Let's go." Stella groaned, rolling over, the sheets knotted around her ankles. She'd always been a wild sleeper, prone to nightmares she never talked about.
"Where?" Stella said. "You know where. I'm tired of talking about it. Let's just go."
She was beginning to feel as if an escape door had appeared before her, and if she waited any longer, it might disappear forever. But she couldn't go without Stella. She'd never been without her sister, and part of her wondered if she could even survive the separation.
"Come on," she said. "Do you want to be cleaning after the DuPonts forever?"
She would never know for sure what did it. Maybe Stella was also bored. Maybe, practical as she was, Stella recognized that they could earn more money in New Orleans, send it home and help Mama better that way. Or maybe she'd seen that escape door vanishing too, and realized that everything she wanted existed outside of Mallard. Who cared why she changed her mind? All that mattered was that Stella finally said, "Okay." All afternoon, the twins lingered at the Founders Day picnic, Desiree feeling like she might burst open from carrying their secret. But Stella seemed just as calm as usual. She was the only person Desiree ever shared her secrets with. Stella knew about the tests Desiree had failed, how she'd forged her mother's signature on the back instead of showing her. She knew about all the knick-knacks Desiree had stolen from Fontenot's. A tube of lipstick, a pack of buttons, a silver cufflink. Because she could. Because it felt nice when the mayor's daughter fluttered past, knowing that she had taken something from her. Stella listened, sometimes judged, but never told. And that was the part that mattered most. Telling Stella a secret was like whispering into a jar and screwing the lid tight. Nothing escaped her. But she hadn't imagined then that Stella was keeping secrets of her own. Days after the Veens twins left Mallard, the river flooded, turning all the roads to muck. If they'd waited a day longer, the storm would have flushed them out. If not rain, then the mud. They would have trudged halfway down Partridge Road, then thought, forget it. They weren't tough girls. Wouldn't have lasted 5 miles down a muddy country road. They would have returned home, drenched, and fallen asleep in their beds. Desiree admitting that she'd been impulsive, Stella that she was only being loyal. But it didn't rain that night. The sky was clear when the twins left home without looking back. On the morning Desiree returned, she got herself half lost on the way to her mother's house. Being half lost was worse than being fully lost. It was impossible to know which part of you knew the way. Partridge Road bled into the woods, and then what? A turn at the river, but which direction? A town always looked different once you'd returned, like a house where all the furniture had shifted 3 inches. You wouldn't mistake it for a stranger's house, but you'd keep banging your shins on the table corners. She paused in the mouth of the woods, overwhelmed by all those pine trees stretching on endlessly. She tried to search for anything familiar, fiddling with her scarf. Through the gauzy blue fabric, you could barely see the bruise.
"Mama," Jude said, "we almost there?"
She was gazing up at Desiree with those big moon eyes, looking so much like Sam that Desiree glanced away. "Yes," she said, "almost."
"How much more?" Just a little while, baby. It's right through these woods. Mama's just catching her bearings, that's all.
The first time Sam hit her, Desiree started to think about returning home. They'd been married 3 years then, but she still felt like they were honeymooners. Sam still made her shiver when he licked icing off her finger or kissed her neck while she pouted into her lipstick. Washington, D.C. had started to feel like a type of home where she might be able to imagine the rest of her life playing out without Stella in it. Then, one spring night, 6 years ago, she'd forgotten to sew a button on his shirt, and when he reminded her, she told him that she was too busy cooking dinner. He'd have to sew it himself. She was tired from work. It was late enough that she could hear the Ed Sullivan Show in the living room, Diane Carroll trilling, "It Had to Be You." She lowered the chicken into the oven, and when she turned, Sam's hand smashed hot against her mouth. She was 24 years old. She had never been slapped in the face before.
"Leave him," her friend Roberta told her over the phone. "You stay, he thinks he can get away with it."
"It ain't that simple," Desiree said. She glanced toward her baby's room, touching her swollen lip. She suddenly imagined Stella's face, her own but unbruised.
"Why," Roberta said, "you love him, and he loves you so much he knocked your head off your shoulders."
"It wasn't that bad," she said.
"And you aim to stick around until it is?"
By the time Desiree found the nerve to leave, she hadn't spoken to Stella since she'd passed over. She had no way to reach her and didn't even know where she lived now. Still, weaving through Union Station, her daughter confused and clinging to her arm, she only wanted to call her sister. Hours earlier, in the middle of another argument, Sam had grabbed her by the throat and aimed his handgun at her face, his eyes as clear as the first time he'd kissed her. He would kill her someday. She knew this even after he released her, and she rolled, gasping, onto her side. That night, she pretended to fall asleep beside him. Then, for the second time in her life, she packed a bag in darkness. At the train station, she raced to the ticket counter with the cash she'd stolen from Sam's wallet, gripping her daughter's hand, breathing so hard her stomach hurt. "What now?" she asked Stella in her head. "Where do I go?" But of course, Stella didn't answer. And of course, there was only one place to go.
"How much more?" Jude asked.
"A little bit, baby. We're almost there." Almost home. But what did that mean anymore? Her mother might cast her out before she even reached the front steps. She would take one look at Jude before pointing them back down the road.
"Of course that dark man beats you. What you expect? A spite marriage don't last."
She stooped to pick up her daughter, hoisting her onto her hip. She was walking now without thinking, just to keep her body moving. Maybe it was a mistake to return to Mallard. Maybe they should have gone somewhere new, started over fresh. But it was too late now for regrets. She could already hear the river. She started toward it, her daughter hanging heavy around her neck. The river would right her. She would stand on the bank and remember the way. In D.C., Desiree Veans had learned to read fingerprints. She had never even known that this was something you could learn until the spring of 1956, when walking down Canal Street, she spotted a flyer tacked outside a bakery window announcing that the federal government was hiring. She paused in the doorway, staring at the poster. Stella had been gone 6 months then, time falling in a slow, steady drip. She would forget sometimes, as strange as it sounded. She would hear a funny joke on the streetcar or pass a friend they once knew, and she would turn to tell Stella, "Hey, did you?" Before remembering that she was gone, that she had left Desiree, for the first time ever, alone. And yet, even after 6 months, Desiree still held out hope. Stella would call. She would send a letter. But each evening, she groped inside the empty mailbox and waited beside a phone that refused to ring. Stella had gone on to craft a new life without her in it, and Desiree was miserable living in the city where Stella abandoned her. So she'd written down the number from the yellow flyer pressed against the bakery window, and she went to the recruitment office as soon as she'd got off from work. The recruiter, skeptical that she'd find anyone of good character in that whole city, was surprised by the neat young woman sitting in front of her. She glanced at her application, stumbling where the girl had marked colored. Then she tapped her pen on the box labeled Hometown.
Mallard, she said. I've never heard of the place.
It's just a little town, Desiree said, north of here.
Mr. Hoover likes small towns. The best folks come from small towns, he always says.
Well, Desiree said, Mallard is as small a town as it gets. In D.C., she tried to bury her grief. She rented a room from the other colored woman in the fingerprinting department, Roberta Thomas. More a basement than a room, actually. Dark and windowless, but clean, and most importantly, affordable.
It ain't much, Roberta told her on her first day of work. But if you really need a place.
She'd offered tentatively, as if she were hoping Desiree might turn her down. She was exhausted, 3 children in all, and honestly, Desiree just seemed like another to take care of. But she pitied the girl, barely 18, alone in a new city. So the basement it was, a single bed, a dresser, the radiator rattling her to sleep each night. Desiree told herself that she was starting over, but she thought of Stella even more now, wondering what she would make of this city. She'd left New Orleans to escape the memory of her, but she still couldn't fall asleep without rolling over to feel for Stella in bed beside her. At the bureau, Desiree learned arches and loops and whorls, a radial loop flowing toward the thumb versus an ulnar loop flowing toward the pinky, a central pocket loop whorl from a double loop whorl, a young finger from an old one whose ridges were worn down with age. She could identify one person out of a million by studying a ridge, its width, shape, pores, contour, breaks, and creases. On her desk each morning, fingerprints lifted from stolen cars and bullet casings, broken windows and door handles and knives. She processed the fingerprints of anti-war protesters and identified the remains of dead soldiers arriving home wedged on dry ice. She was studying fingerprints lifted from a stolen gun the first time Sam Winston walked past. He wore a lavender tie with a matching silk handkerchief, and she was shocked by the brightness of the tie and the boldness of the jet-black brother who'd found the nerve to wear it. Later, when she saw him eating lunch with the other attorneys, she turned to Roberta and said, "I didn't know there were colored prosecutors." Roberta snorted.
"Of course there is," she said. "This ain't that down-poke town you come from."
Roberta had never heard of Mallard. Nobody outside of St. Landry Parish had. And when Desiree told Sam, he struggled to even imagine it.
"You're jiving," he said. "A whole town of folks as light as you."
He'd invited her to lunch one afternoon, leaning over her cubicle after he'd stopped by to ask about a set of fingerprints. Later, he told her that he hadn't been so desperate about those prints at all. He just wanted to find a reason to introduce himself. Now they were sitting in the National Arboretum, watching ducks glide over the pond.
"Lighter even,"
she said, thinking about Mrs. Fontenot, who'd always boasted that her children were the color of clabber. Sam laughed.
"Well, you gotta bring me down there sometime," he said. I gotta see this light-skinned city for myself.
But he was only flirting. He was born in Ohio and had never ventured south of Virginia. His mother had wanted to send him to Morehouse, but no, he was a Buckeye back before all the dormitories desegregated. He'd sat in classrooms where white professors refused to answer his questions. He'd scraped piss-yellow snow off his windshield each winter, dated light girls who would not hold his hand in public. Northern racism, he knew. That Southern kind, you could keep. As far as he was concerned, his folks had escaped the South for a reason, and who was he to question their judgment? Those rednecks probably wouldn't even let him come home, he always joked. He might go down to visit and wind up chopping cotton.
You wouldn't like mallet, she told him.
Why not?
Because they funny down there, color struck. That's why I left.
Not exactly. Although she wanted him to believe that she was nothing like the place she'd come from. She wanted him to believe anything beside the truth. That she was only young and bored, and she'd dragged her sister to a city where she'd lost herself. He was quiet a minute, considering this. Then he tilted the bag of breadcrumbs toward her. He had been ripping up the crust of his sandwich so she could feed the ducks, the type of subtle gallantry she would learn to love about him. She smiled, dipping her hand inside. She told him that she had never been with a man like him before, but the truth was, she had never really been with a man at all. So she was surprised and delighted by every little thing he did. Sam escorting her into restaurants with white tablecloths and ornate silverware. Sam inviting her to the theater, surprising her with tickets to see Ella Fitzgerald. When he brought her home the first time, she'd wandered around his bachelor's apartment, amazed by his neat linens, his color-coded wardrobe, his big, spacious bed. She'd nearly cried when she'd returned to Roberta's basement after that. He would never again offer to visit home with her. She would never ask him to. She'd told him in the beginning that she hated Mallard.
I don't believe you, he said.
They were lying in his bed, listening to the rain.
What's there to believe? I told you how I feel.
Negroes always love our hometowns, he said, even though we're always from the worst places. Only white folks got the freedom to hate home.
He was raised in the projects of Cleveland, and he loved that city with the fierceness of someone who hadn't been given much to love. She'd only been given a town she'd always wanted to escape, and a mother who'd made it clear that she was not welcomed back. She hadn't told Sam about Stella yet. It seemed like another thing about Mallor that he wouldn't understand. But as rain splattered against the metal fire escape, she turned toward him and said that she had a twin sister who'd decided to become someone else.
She'll get tired of all that play acting, he said. Bet she comes running back, feeling foolish. You're way too sweet for anyone to stay away.
He kissed her forehead, and she held him tighter, his heart thumping against her ear. This was back in the beginning. Before his hands curled into fists, before he called her uppity yellow bitch, or crazy as your sister, or off thinking you white. Back when she'd found herself starting to trust him. Many years later, when her eyesight would begin to fade, she would blame the years she'd spent squinting at sheets of fingerprints and marking their ridges. Roberta told her once that soon the entire fingerprinting system would be operated by machines. The Japanese were already testing out the technology. But how could a machine study a fingerprint better than the trained eye? Desiree saw patterns that most people couldn't. She could read a person's life off his fingertips. During training, she'd practiced reading her own fingerprints, those intricate designs that marked her as unique. Stella had a scar on her left index finger from when she'd cut herself with a knife. One of many ways that their fingerprints were different.
Sometimes who you were came down to the small things. Adele Veens lived in a white shotgun house that lurked on the edge of the woods, a house first built by the founder and inhabited by generations of DeCures ever since. When she'd first married, her new husband, Leon Veens, had wandered down the hall inspecting the ancient furniture. He was a repairman who wanted to be a woodworker, and he ran a finger along the slender table legs, admiring the craftsmanship. He'd never expected to one day live in a home imbued with so much history, but then again, he'd never expected to marry a DeCure girl. A girl with heritage. He could trace his own family to a long line of French wine growers who'd hoped to build a vineyard in the New World before discovering that Louisiana was too hot and humid for grapes and settled instead for sugarcane. Big thinking crushed by reality. That's what he'd inherited. His own parents had set their sights more reasonably. They'd run a speakeasy on the edge of Mallard called the Surly Goat. The more pious in Mallard would later trace the tragedies to that sinful business. Four Veens brothers, none of whom lived past 30. Leon, the runt of the litter, the first to die. The house had faded with time, but somehow still seemed exactly as Desiree had remembered it. She stepped into the clearing, gripping her own daughter tighter, shoulders stinging with each step. Those brass columns, teal roof, the narrow front porch where her mother was sitting on a rocking chair, snapping green beans into a bowl of water. Her mother still slight, her hair trailing down her back, temples now tinted gray. Desiree paused, her daughter hanging heavy from her neck. The years pushing her back like a hand to her chest.
Wondering when y'all would make it out here? You know, Lou already called, saying he seen you.
Her mother was talking to her, but staring at the child in her arms.
Mighty big to be carried.
Desiree finally set her daughter down. Her back ached, but pain at least felt familiar. A hurting body kept you alert, awake, which was better than how numb she'd felt on the train, moving but trapped in place. She nudged her daughter forward.
Go give your mama a kiss, she said. Go on, it's all right.
Her daughter clamped around her legs, too shy to move, but she nudged her again until the girl dutifully climbed the steps, hesitating a second, before she put an arm around her grandmother. Adele pulled back to get a better look at her, touching her must braids.
Go take a bath, she said. Y'all smell like outside.
In the bathroom, Desiree knelt on the cracked tile to run her daughter a bath in the clawfoot tub. She tested the water, feeling somehow as if she were dreaming. The mirror, blackened in the top corner, the chipped, scalloped sink, the wooden floors, creaking in the places she'd learned to avoid if she wanted to sneak in past curfew. Her mother snapping green beans on the porch as if it were a normal morning. And yet they hadn't spoken since Stella left. Desiree had called home, gulping back tears, and her mother said, "You did this." What could she even say? She was the one who'd pushed Stella to leave home in the first place. Now her sister had decided she'd rather be white, and her mother blamed her because Stella was no longer there to blame. In the kitchen, she sank into a chair, realizing a moment later that she'd sat in the same place she always had, Stella's chair empty beside her. Her mother was busying at the stove, and for a long moment, Desiree stared at her stiffened back.
So that's what you've been up to, her mother said.
What do you mean?
You know what I mean.
Her mother turned, her eyes brimming with tears.
You hate us that much, don't you?
Desiree pushed away from the table.
I knew I shouldn't have come here. Sit down.
If that's all you got to say to me, what do you expect? You come from God knows where, dragging some child that don't look one lick like you.
We'll go, Desiree said. You can be mad at me all you want, Mama, but you're not gonna be nasty to my girl.
I said sit down, her mother said again, this time quieter.
She slid a yellow square of cornbread across the table.
I'm just surprised. Can't I be surprised?
All those times Desiree had imagined calling home, when she'd arrived in D.C., settling in Roberta's basement, her mother with no way to reach her. Or after Sam proposed, and they took engagement photographs under the cherry blossoms. She'd slid a picture into an envelope, even addressed it, but she couldn't bring herself to send it. Not because she was ashamed of him. That was how Sam took it. But because what was the point of sharing good news with someone who couldn't be happy for you? She already knew what her mother would tell her. You don't love that dark man. You're only marrying him out of rebellion. And the worst thing to give a rebelling child is attention. You'll understand someday when you have a child of your own. After the wedding, after the cake had been cut, after their friends had wandered boozy and laughing into the streets, she'd slumped in the back of the reception hall in her frilly white dress and cried. She had never imagined that she might get married someday without her sister and mother by her side. She'd even thought about calling after she'd given birth to a baby girl at Freedman's Hospital. When Jude was born, the colored nurse had paused before wrapping her in a pink blanket.
It's good luck, she'd finally said, handing her over, for a girl to look like her daddy.
She smiled a little after, offering reassurance to a woman she believed would need it. But Desiree stared into her baby's face, enchanted. A different woman might have been disappointed by how little her own daughter resembled her, but she only felt grateful. The last thing she wanted was to love someone else who looked just like herself.
Would have fixed more if you told me you was coming, her mother said. It was sort of last minute, Desiree said.
She'd barely eaten on the train, nibbling on crackers and gulping black coffee until the caffeine made her jittery. She needed to plan. Mallard, and then what? Where to next? They couldn't possibly stay here, but she didn't know where else to go. Now she stared around the aging kitchen, missing her own apartment in D.C., her job, her friends, her life. Maybe she'd overreacted. The riots had set everyone on edge. A week ago, she'd watched Sam cry as Walter Cronkite delivered the news, holding him on the couch as he trembled in her arms. The shooter was a madman, maybe, or a military operative, or perhaps even an agent in the Bureau acting on behalf of the government. They were culpable, perhaps, complicit Negroes working for the wrong side. He was rambling, and she clutched him until the broadcast ended. That night, they'd made love desperately, a strange way to honor the Reverend, maybe. But she didn't feel like herself that night, overwhelmed by grief over a man she didn't know. In the morning, she passed ravaged storefronts with Soul Brother scribbled on boarded shop windows, hasty claims of allegiance written in marker and pasted against glass. The Bureau dismissed early that day. On her walk home from the bus, a scared colored youth, scrawny as the baseball bat he was gripping, demanded her pocketbook. "Come on, you white bitch," he screamed, slamming the bat against the pavement as if he could drill to the center of the earth. She fumbled with her leather strap, too afraid to correct him, recognizing herself in his terror and fury. When Sam leapt in front of her, arms raised, and said, "This my woman, brother." The teen ran off into the den. Sam swept her inside the apartment,
holding her against the safety of his chest. The city lit up 4 nights, and on the last night, Sam gripped her naked body and whispered, "Let's make another." It took her a moment to realize he meant a baby. She'd hesitated. She hadn't meant to, but the thought of another baby anchoring her to him, another baby to worry about every time Sam was in a rage, she could never have another baby with him. Of course, she didn't tell him this, but her hesitation made it clear. And later, when he'd grabbed her throat, she knew exactly why. She'd wounded him while he was still grieving. No wonder he'd gotten angry. So he liked to throw his weight around a little. Who could blame him, living in a world that refused to respect him as a man? She didn't have to be so mouthy. She could try harder to make a peaceful home. Wasn't this the same man who'd stood between her and an angry boy's bat? The same man who'd loved her after her sister abandoned her and her mother refused her phone calls? Maybe it wasn't too late. They'd only been gone 2 days. She could always call Sam, tell him that she'd made a mistake. She'd needed a little time to clear her head, that's all. Of course, she'd never seriously meant to leave. Her mother pushed the plate toward her again. "What type of trouble you in?" she said. Desiree forced a laugh.
"There's no trouble, Mama."
"I ain't stupid. You think I don't know you running from that man of yours?"
Desiree stared down at the table, her eyes welling up. Her mother poured milk onto the cornbread and mushed it with a fork, the way Desiree had eaten it as a girl.
"He gone now," her mother said. "Eat your cornbread."
Late that night, over 100 miles southeast of Mallard, Early Jones received a job offer that would alter the course of his life. He didn't know this at the time. Any job was just that to him, a job. And when he stepped inside Ernesto's, craning his neck for Big Seal, he was only worried about whether he could afford a drink. He jangled the loose change in his pocket. Could never keep a dollar on him. 2 weeks ago, he'd run a job for Seal, and somehow he'd burned through the money already on everything a young man alone in New Orleans required. Card games and booze and women. Now he was desperate for another job. For the money, of course, but also because he hated being in one place for too long. And 2 weeks in the same place was, for him then, far too long. He wasn't a settling man. He was only good at getting lost. He'd mastered that particular skill as a boy, rooted nowhere. Spent his childhood, if you could call it that, sharecropping on farms in Janesville and Jenna, down south to New Roads and Palmetto. He'd been given to his aunt and uncle when he was 8, because they had no children, and his parents had too many. He did not know where his parents lived now, if they still lived, and he said that he never thought about them.
"They gone," he said when asked. "Gone, folks, is gone."
But the truth is that when he'd first started hunting hiding people, he tried to find his folks. His failure was swift and humiliating. He didn't know enough about his parents to even guess where to begin. Probably for the best. They hadn't wanted him as a boy. What on earth would they do with him as a grown man? Still, his defeat nagged at him. Since he'd started hunting, his parents were the only people he had never found. The key to staying lost was to never love anything. Time and time again, Early was amazed by what a running man came back for. Women, mostly. In Jackson, he'd caught a man wanted for attempted murder because he'd circled back for his wife. You could find a new woman anywhere. But then again, the most violent men were always the most sentimental. Pure emotion, any way you look at it. What really got him were the men who returned for belongings. Too many goddamn cars to count, always some junk a man had driven for years and couldn't part with. In Toledo, he'd caught a man who'd returned to his childhood home for an old baseball.
"I don't know, man," he said, cuffed in the backseat of Early's El Camino. "I just really loved that thing."
Love had never dragged Early anywhere. As soon as he left a place, he forgot it. Names faded, faces blurred, buildings smudged into indistinguishable brick slabs. He forgot the names of teachers at all the schools he'd attended, the streets where he'd lived, even what his parents looked like. This was his gift, a short memory. A long memory could drive a man crazy. He'd been running jobs for Seal off and on for 7 years now. He never wanted anyone to think that he was working for the law. He caught criminals for one reason only, the money. And he didn't give two shits about the white man's justice. After he caught a man, he never wondered if the jury convicted him or if the man survived prison. He forgot him altogether. And though he'd been recognized in a bar once and still wore the knife scars across his stomach as a souvenir, forgetting was the only way he could do his job. He liked hunting criminals. Each time Seal approached him about a missing child or a deadbeat father, Early shook his head.
"Don't know nothing about none of those people," he said, tilting back his whiskey.
In Ernesto's, Seal shrugged. He had a proper office in the 7th Ward, but Early hated meeting him there, across the street from a church, all those sanctified folks staring at him as they trampled down the steps. This bar was Early's kind of place, a little shadowy and safe. Seal was a hefty man, cardboard colored with silky black hair. He carried a silver cigarette lighter that he twirled between his fingers while he talked. He'd been twirling that lighter the first time he'd approached Early in a bar like this one, years ago. Early had listened half-heartedly, watching the light glint off the silver and dance along the bar.
"Son, how'd you like to make some money?" Seal asked.
He didn't look like a gangster or pimp, but he carried the sleaziness of someone who did barely legal work. He was a bail bondsman, looking for a new bounty hunter, and he'd noticed Early.
"You got a quiet way about you," he said. "That's good. I need a man to look and listen."
Early was 24 then, fresh out of prison, alone in New Orleans because he'd figured it as good a place to start over as any. He took the job because he needed the work. He'd never expected to be good at it. So good, in fact, that Seal kept approaching him with jobs that had nothing to do with bail bonds.
"You know about them what I tell you," Seal said, "and I ain't told you nothing yet." "Well, I don't like to be caught up in folks' affairs. Don't you have nothing else for me?"
Seal laughed.
"You about the only man I ever hear say that. Everybody else I talk to be glad not to hunt down some mean son of a bitch for a change."
But Early could at least understand how a wanted man thought. The exhaustion, the desperation, the sheer selfishness of survival. The otherwise disappeared baffled him. He certainly didn't understand married folks and had no desire to get in between them. Then again, a job was a job. Why wouldn't he take on something light? He'd just spent 2 weeks tracking a man halfway to Mexico. His car broke down in the desert, and he'd wondered if he would die out there, hunting a man he didn't even care to see punished. If the money was all the same, why not say yes to an easy job for once?
"I'm not grabbing her," he said. "Nothing like that. You just call when you find her. The old man's looking for her. She run off with his kid." "What's she run off for?"
Seal shrugged.
"Not my concern. Man wants her found. She from some little town up north called Mallet. Ever heard of it? Passed through as a boy, Early said. Funny place, highfalutin.
He remembered little about the town, except that everyone was light and uppity. And once, at mass, a tall, pale man had slapped him for dipping his finger into the holy water font before the man's wife. He was 16 then, shocked by the sudden sting on his neck as his uncle grabbed his shoulder, staring at the cracked tile floor, and apologized. He'd spent a summer in that place, working a farm on the edge of town and delivering groceries to earn extra cash. He didn't make a single friend, but he did nurse a futile crush on a girl he'd met carrying groceries up her porch steps. He didn't know how she even entered his mind. He was so young when they'd met, he'd barely known her. By fall, he'd moved on to another farm in another town. Still, he saw her standing barefoot in her living room, washing the windows. When Seal slid him the photograph, Early's stomach lurched. He almost felt as if he'd willed it. For the first time in 10 years, he was staring at Desiree Veens's face. Chapter 2. The Veens twins left without saying goodbye, so like any sudden disappearance, their departure became loaded with meaning. Before they surfaced in New Orleans, before they were just bored girls hunting fun, it only made sense to lose them in such a tragic way. The twins had always seemed both blessed and cursed. They'd inherited from their mother the legacy of an entire town, and from their father, a lineage hollowed by loss. 4 Veens boys, all dead by 30. The eldest collapsed in a chain gang from heat stroke, the second gassed in a Belgian trench, the third stabbed in a bar fight, and the youngest, Leon Veens, lynched twice, the first time at home, while his twin girls watched through a crack in the closet door, hands clamped over each other's mouths until their palms misted with spit. That night, he was whittling a table leg when 5 white men kicked in the front door and hauled him outside. He landed hard on his face, his mouth filling with dirt and blood. The mob leader, a tall white man with red-gold hair like a fall apple, waved a crumpled note in which he claimed Leon had written nasty things to a white woman. Leon couldn't read or write. His customers knew that he made all of his marks with an X, but the white men stomped on his hands, broke every finger and joint, then shot him 4 times. He survived, and 3 days later, the white men burst into the hospital and stormed every room in the colored ward until they found him. This time, they shot him twice in the head, his cotton pillowcase blooming red. Desiree witnessed the first lynching, but would forever imagine the second, how her father must have been sleeping, his head slumped, the way he nodded off in his chair after supper, how the thundering boots woke him. He screamed, or maybe had no time to, his swollen hands bandaged and useless at his sides. From the closet, she'd watched the white men drag her father out of the house, his long legs drumming against the floor. She suddenly felt that her sister would scream, so she squeezed her hand over Stella's mouth, and seconds later, felt Stella's hand on her own. Something shifted between them in that moment. Before, Stella seemed as predictable as a reflection. But in the closet, for the first time ever, Desiree hadn't known what her sister might do. At the wake, the twins wore matching black dresses with full slips that itched their legs. Days earlier, Bernice LeGros, the seamstress,